From college to the pros, America's pastime in full force, 24/7 on The Long Ball with Andrew Brown.
That's right, everybody. Welcome one, welcome all back inside The Long Ball with Andrew Brown. I'm Andrew Brown, and for those unfamiliar with this show, it's a show where I dive into baseball on the collegiate and professional standpoint, and I try to bring in some great interviews to talk about some really great topics in both the collegiate and professional levels. But from time to time, if there's a great storyline out there that I'd like to follow, then I'll do so outside the world of baseball as well. And if you want to catch the show on Twitter at TheLongBall1. All episodes are up on there. And, of course, on my Twitter page at abrown_13878. Please like it. Please share it. Have fun with it. Still getting a Facebook page up, but will do here very shortly. Other than that, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining in. Thanks, everybody, for questions. I know it's been a week or so. I've had a little technical difficulties getting stuff posted up to the site, but those should be all squared away right now, and we should be good to go. Please, if you do get a chance, like all the prior shows as well. A lot of great guys on, from the Louisville head baseball coach Dan McDonald to all the way to Dan Savette, former third-round draft pick, and from Major League Baseball, that is. So a lot going on and a lot to look forward to. So go ahead, look, just check out some of the past interviews. Soon I'll be getting up my interview with Bob Tufts, a former major leaguer for the Pittsburgh Pirates and San Francisco Giants. So please take a look at that when you get the chance. A great baseball interview for you here this episode, ladies and gentlemen, as we have the one and only familiar face to this show and a familiar face to a lot. It's Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. He's going to join me as we take a look at the trade deadline from an after or post-trade deadline effect. Not just about who got what, the meaning of what, but really, now that we've seen a couple games, two, three, five games of these new people with their new teams, what do we like and what are we seeing out of them? And kind of a post-trade deadline effect. And going to break down the Miami Marlins a little bit. And I know we've done that before, but this time it is because, again, from the standpoint of we view teams that are in the hunt, and every year we are all eyes are on them. But I like to look at how a winning team is made and how it is developed. Houston Astros went through this in historic fashion, and now the Miami Marlins are going through something similar, but they're well on the rise. They're there. They probably won't be relevant for another 3 to 4 years, but it's always fascinating to see the pieces that may be in place for a future rising Miami Marlins team. So that's what we're going to take a look at as well. And again, all with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. But first, although we appreciate the present, it's, you know, you really can't appreciate the present enough without appreciating the past. And that's why I'm going to dive into one of my newest segments called This Week in Baseball's Past.
From the ground balls to grand slams, from strikeouts to perfect games, it's time to take a look back in time on This Week in Baseball's Past.
For This Week in Baseball's Past, we dive back to August 13th of 1995. It was a somber day in the world of baseball as Iron Man Mickey Mantle died at the age of 63. One of the most iconic players in MLB history, the pinstripe Yankee hit 536 home runs over an 18-year career. He also belted out a major league record 18 home runs in World Series play. His lengthy blast inspired the introduction of the phrase tape measure home runs. In spite of repetitive knee injuries, the Mick, as they called him, won 3 American League MVP awards and took home the Triple Crown in 1956. He went into the Hall of Fame in 1974, his first year of eligibility.
After retiring as a player in the spring of 1969, Mantle briefly became a coach and later served as an announcer on the Yankees cable television broadcasts.
And there you have it, folks, another edition diving into all that is baseball history on This Week in Baseball's Past.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we continue on with the long ball with Andrew Brown. And you know what, ladies and gentlemen, I got to say that there are a lot of great conversations recently over the last couple weeks because of the trade deadline. You look up and you see a lot of good discussion, a lot of good points. But again, I dip into this well a lot, and the reason being because it's needed. And I say the wealth of information, the knowledge that is Wayne McDonald Jr., because I have him on right now. We're talking with him, and we're going to dive into the trade deadline and a little bit about the Miami Marlins. We're going to really kind of hit that hard and heavy here in this episode. And again, ladies and gentlemen, check out for the past episodes. The technical glitch with the Bob Tufts interview will be fixed. We'll have that up here very shortly. And, of course, then when you combine that with this interview here today for this week, you're going to have a good time. But, again, the one and only Wayne McDonald Jr. joining the show again. Wayne, you know what? I could not have thought of any better person to talk about the trade deadline stuff with, because you and I were talking. I had something right in place, ready to go rearing. But as MLB happens, you really can't. You have to be on your toes, especially around the trade deadline.
Oh, and that's the beauty of this time of year, because teams are either buyers or sellers. And then if you are a seller, you're looking to rebuild for the future. And that's where, from a fan's perspective, you can see a lot of excitement, even when your team is not in playoff contention this year. So there's so much going on. We're going to dig into it. We're going to have a good time. And all our listeners are really going to learn a lot today.
And, you know, one thing I was really curious with is how would the singular trade deadline where you – I mean – you can't do very much after this now. You got July 31st. That's your big deal. I was curious. Was it going to be hot and heavy? Was it going to be non-existent? Were teams going to be too scared to pull the trigger? And because it means that much, you know, now that we get to sit back and look at it, what was your take on how teams reacted? Was it more precautionary, aggressive, or kind of where do you stand on that?
I think it was very lukewarm. For the fact that up until the Greinke deal, we saw a lot of teams saying we're going to be buyers, because the second wild card dramatically changes how a team goes after it for the postseason. I think we all got shocked with the Marcus Stroman trade to the Mets. And now, you know, a week and a half later, you look at that and go, well, you know, that probably wasn't that bad of a deal for the sake that the Mets are actually in it, you know, surprisingly, because of the second wild card. I think that if you're a ball club that's within seven games of that second wild card position right before the trade deadline, your thought process is, I'm in it. I have an opportunity. Where in the past, it was very black or white. You're a buyer, you're a seller. And then you had the non-waiver transactions that happened in August, where you still had some flexibility. Here, this July 31st deadline basically said you're either in it or you're not in it. Make a decision. And that's what I think was so fascinating about what we saw over the past week.
Wayne McDonald Jr., Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. You know, this was – it was really interesting. It sure was, because there was so much tension, so much, excitement, I should say, so much curiosity as – to what would go on. And one thing that you and I have had a conversation with is kind of where the market goes in terms of favoring, you know, the starter versus the reliever versus this position, that position. I still think that when you look at a lot of teams, and the Yankees kind of on the downside of this, as we were kind of talking earlier, but a lot of teams, especially the Braves, they went out and got some good arms. It went and specifically went to the bullpen, but a lot of teams that were in contention, a lot of the talk was, hey, they need bullpen. They need bullpen. They need bullpen. And I
I think it's coming to a consensus that bullpen is always going to be a need, or is always going to be something that may not be fully fulfilled, unlike, you know, the Phillies of old. But, you know, I think that this was interesting because, like you said, up until the Greinke deal, for me, I thought it was, hey, in terms of the pitching market, relievers were more, I guess, highly coveted. But I don't know anymore. You know, I look at it, the Stroman deal was big, and then the Greinke deal was big. I didn't know if his contract would be unloaded, but man, it's interesting now because I'm not sure where I stand on where the value was put in terms of the pitching.
Here's how I look at it, because there's a lot of different layers here, and I think you have to start from the perspective of what ball club you're dealing with. For instance, you bring in Zach Greinke to the Houston Astros along with a Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole, and then you throw in Aaron Sanchez as well. That's lethal. And that makes total sense. Whereas a team like the Minnesota Twins, when they go out and get a guy like a Sergio Romo from the Miami Marlins, that's a highly logical move for them because they have to bulk up their bullpen. I look at teams like the Twins and the Rays in particular, who are in the middle of this hotly contested postseason push, and bullpens are very important to them. And they did good jobs of, you know, bolstering that. So I think it's an organizational philosophy. I think if, you know, what you already have, let's face it, it was Madison Bumgarner, it was Marcus Strohman, and Trevor Bauer, the three big starting pitchers whose names were constantly circulated. And we found out two of the three moved. And the reason why the Giants kept Bumgarner is because mathematically, they still are really in the throes of this conversation in terms of the second wild card. So I do believe it depends on the franchise. You know, I'm an old school guy. I love elite starting pitching. And when I heard within seconds of the trade deadline that the Greinke deal went through to the Astros, my knees buckled. Because I knew right away, in a best of five series in that first ALDS, the Astros are going to roll out in the first three games something like Verlander, Greinke, and Cole. That's a formidable position. But then if you're the Tampa Rays, you're going to put out maybe, you know, a Blake Snell and then go by the bullpen by committee, and that can be just as effective because of the way they approach the game. So I think there are so many different dynamics at play here. I think it's predicated on what you have on your roster right now after the trade deadline. But it depends on the franchise, and it depends on the depth of your pitching. And the Astros still adhere to, you know, we have two or three guys, give me the ball, let me go seven or eight innings, rather than what the Rays are doing where we have openers. So that's, I think, the beautiful aspect of baseball right now is that there is this one overarching philosophy, because you still have those throwback pitches in the likes of a Kershaw or a Verlander, and to a lesser extent these days a Sabathia. They're a dying breed in the game, but in the same token, they're still part of the conversation for the postseason, whereas I think the trend going forward is going to be this more of this bullpenning and openers, which I'm not really a fan of, and I think we need to appreciate what we're seeing with the likes of Greinke and Verlander and Kershaw and pitches of that ilk, because we're probably not going to see them for too much longer.
Once again, everybody, you're listening to The Long Ball with Andrew Brown, my guest Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes, SportsMoneyForbes.com. And, of course, we are talking about the effects of what has been an interesting MLB trade deadline. Again, we're a week and a half out, and I wanted to kind of phrase things from the standpoint of the effects and what we may see. You know, so many people go out and get right at the trade deadline and say, hey, what's, you know, what do we get? What are winners, losers looking like? And again, Wayne, you have definitely turned me from, hey, let's look at the winners and losers side to, hey, we don't know a winner or loser until we know a winner and loser. So,
yeah, that's absolutely correct, because I've never been a fan of that. Because on paper, yeah, it looks great on July 31st. You know, talk to me at the end of October who really won. You know, and that's all that matters when you're really talking these July 31st, you know, trades All those teams want to not only make the playoffs, but they want to get to the World Series. And there's only going to be one team that's going to say, hey, it really worked out for us in our favor, because there's going to be 29 ball clubs that are going to be going home without that World Series trophy.
That is so true. And I think that I think there's, of course, I know a lot of the media has to put out something, and I know they have to try something, but it is interesting, because you go back to around the 2015, the 16 era, and there was a time when a lot of people were trying to get those starters, trying to trade for the aces, trade for the starters. And I remember David Price going to Toronto and having so much trouble in the postseason. And everyone at the beginning, right when he got there, said Toronto, they win. They're the winners. They have won this thing. They're gonna go win. They're gonna do it. And you know what? They didn't do a whole lot in the postseason. And it was very interesting to me to look at that, and especially now, and go, yeah, you know what? Everything I say from now on has to be from, hey, we don't know until we know. And I think that this trade deadline, for sure, I think teams may have been on that line of thinking as well, because again, you just talked about it. You know what makes 100% sense. No one's going out on a limb here for some of these guys. You talked about Sergio Romo, and I saw him. I saw him pitch against Atlanta during this past series, and man, in the times I saw him, he was good, and his delivery has been good. You talk about Greinke to the Astros, and man, that is a phenomenal rotation now that once the postseason happens, it's going to be hard to beat. So I don't know. Am I wrong in saying that teams may have already kind of had that feeling now, that the teams are saying, hey, we don't know winners until we absolutely know we're winners?
Well, I you have a great example in Romo. Look at it from this perspective. There's always going to be the have versus have not mentality in the game with regard to the finances. The Twins don't have the money that the Yankees do, but the Twins are a really good ball club and are built to be a very competitive ball club come the month of October. So a move for like a guy like Sergio Romo makes all the sense in the world for them, but for three primary reasons. He's a veteran with significant playoff experience. He has an expiring contract at the end of the year, and he's only costing the Twins roughly $800,000 off a one-year, $2.5 million contract they originally signed with the Miami Marlins. So that move clearly says to me, Twins want to win right now. They're putting all their eggs in one basket with regard to a guy like Romo on the trade deadline. And if it doesn't work out, they're not stuck with an albatross of a contract, unlike the case with the Astros when you trade for a Zach Greinke, who has a highly complicated contract with deferred compensation and a lot of different layers to it. They're saying, not only do we want to win now, but next year as well. So some of these trades, you know, have layers to them where, you know, shoring up your bullpen with veterans with expiring contracts might make sense for, say, the Twins or the Brewers or teams like that. The Astros and the Yankees kind of missed out on it. They're looking for arms that could be successful for the next couple of years, because their window of opportunity is open more for them rather than other teams are. So it's a whole different thought process and dynamic that actually goes into this thinking.
Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com, joining here on the Long Ball. Interestingly enough, you know, one thing that brought up to my mind, and I'm not sure exactly who it was or what it was. You know, it may have been the contract of Greinke, and he may have played for his last team with Arizona. But you know, long past are the days anyway, where a single player would stay with a single team for their entire career. And you know, I just watched on TV. An interview with George Brett and talking about the Kansas City Royals, and I look back and I remember some of those. You know, for me,
my first remembrance, my first indoctrination into a guy that would only be with one team was Chipper Jones. You know, and he's the guy that I first got indoctrinated with that for me was the epitome of he's not going to go anywhere. And but, you know, nowadays you've moved some of the big guys. I mean, Marcus Stroman, at the beginning of the season, he got angry because he wanted to be a Blue Jay for life, and that did not come through. And you saw and you've seen other players really make a push for, I want to stay here, I'm going to be a part of this team. But is it, you know, I know we have guys like, you know, like Freddie Freeman out there now, Alex Bregman, other guys, but do you feel in today's age, especially with the trade deadline now, that's, yeah, like you said, either you're not or you're in or you're out, do you feel like we will ever have a single player that will remain for a team throughout their career? Do you ever feel like we will come into contact with that scenario yet again?
Well, I think we saw this year's Hall of Fame class with guys like Mariano Rivera and Edgar Martinez, and then next year you're going to see it with Derek Jeter, that, you know, that they will be always eternally remembered for playing for one franchise. And you brought up a phenomenal example in Chipper Jones. You know, I think because of the way the economics have dramatically changed, I think also the way, you know, winning has been viewed. I think, you know, I don't want to say gone are the days of playing your entire career with one team, but I kind of put that in the same category as the elite starting pitcher who's going to throw, you know, make 35 starts a year and over 200 strikeouts and over 250 innings pitched. That stuff is not going to happen with regularity anymore, and I do believe probably the last guy, you know, a current player that you would think of is Mike Trout. You know, he signed that mammoth deal with the Angels, and, you know, I think he's going to be an Angel for life. And I think those are going to be rarities. It was kind of funny. Something bothered me early this morning, and was, how many teams did Zach Greinke play for? You know, and, you know, you had to go to baseballreference.com because, you know, but you wanted, you took a double take, you know, for all the teams he played for. Such a great pitcher, but it's just the nature of the game right now. I mean, same thing, look at basketball. Look at LeBron James. You know, this elite, surefire first ballot, probably one of the top five greatest players to have ever played basketball. Look at all the teams he's played for. So I think that's going to be the norm. And if you want to take it a step further, I think, you know, a lot was made of Mike Mussina and Roy Halladay going into Cooperstown this year with empty baseball caps, clearly because of the way their careers coincided with the teams to which they play for. I think that might be more of the norm these days. You know, a guy like Mussina, 10 years with the Orioles, 8 with the Yankees, Halladay with the Blue Jays and the Phillies. You know, I do believe that you're going to see a lot more of that. I don't believe that you're going to see, you know, with great regularity, guys staying with one team just because of the nature of the game these days.
How much would you say that that prospects would factor into that? Because it seems nowadays that, you know, in some instances they're fluid. I mean, you'll see first rounders get traded, but then again, almost the entire conversation with some of these sellers is, what return can we get for the future? So, again, how much, in your aspect, is it significant enough for us to really look at? Or how would you gauge the effectiveness or the impact of prospects on this whole situation?
Well, I look at everything through the collective bargaining agreement and the competitive balance tax and the taxes in terms of the penalties on draft picks for overspending and the different layers of the luxury tax. And teams are tired of losing money in the luxury tax penalties. They don't want to lose draft picks. They don't want to lose money in the international bonus pools because there's all of these repercussions if they grossly overspend on the major league roster. So if a team has an opportunity to trade, you know, a perennial all-star with a nine-figure contract and can get some relief, they're going to do it. I mean, you look at the Diamondbacks. The Diamondbacks really could not financially sustain having a player like Zach Greinke. So they were able to find a willing buyer in terms of the Astros, and they had a ton of top-flight prospects in return. So I think I look at it from this perspective. What you're getting in return, say when you trade a guy like a Zach Greinke, besides the significant financial relief, you're also getting players that are very controllable, because clearly they're either minor league ball players or they're pre-arbitration eligible ball players. So you're controlling your cost. You're getting players that are young enough that you could put into your system that you can mold and develop with your people. And also you get a financial relief on the major league roster, which is critical. So there's so many different layers to it, but when you're these big teams like the Yankees, the Red Sox, the Astros, you know, the Cubs, the Dodgers, they can take on players like this because of the local revenues that are coming into their market. You know, I wrote about it. The Miami Marlins, by no means were they ever going to be in the business of Marcus Stroman, Madison Bumgarner, and Trevor Bauer for a myriad of reasons, but neither would be the Minnesota Twins. They were probably in on Stroman, but, you know, a Zach Greinke, absolutely not, because Stroman's attractive because he's controllable for another year or so. Bumgarner is attractive because he's a free agent at the end of the year, where Greinke is a financial liability. So I kind of look at everything through the lens of the collective bargaining agreement, finances, and teams rather be able to control their costs and develop their prospects and kind of hold them until the point where they have to put them on the 40-man and even the 25-man roster until their clock starts ticking at the major league level.
Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com, joining us here as we continue on with the long ball. Catch it on Twitter at TheLongBall1, also on my official Twitter page at abrown_13878. This will be shared across social media, also on Facebook, so please go ahead, search Andrew Brown in the Long Ball. Check this out. Really appreciate all the help and all the listens, you know, and I really appreciate the help. And please show the love on Twitter. Would love that too. Now, as we continue on, one thing too, interesting enough, I found myself more shifting towards the teams that may not be in the hunt right now for a postseason at this moment. But it's really interesting because when you look back at the teams that are now dominant, they had to go through kind of this process. Astros, obviously the most famous or most formidable. You take a look at some of the moves that the Twins made to kind of bump up after a bad year. So I'm always interested now to see from the standpoint of the teams who are not in it right now, but with the pathway to get there. And the Miami Marlins are definitely in that route right now. You know, now we've had time to digest some of their moves. Didn't make a ton of moves, but, you know, I think people don't look at the, hey, what's the positive impact for the team that are getting the prospects back. But I think the Miami Marlins did, I think they were very calculated. They did a good job. And you've been covering this here. What was your take on how they came away with this trade deadline scenario?
I think over the next 3 years, we're going to look back on the Miami Marlins and we're going to look at the months of June and July 2019 as pivotal months in the franchise's history. And what I say for that is they had a very productive draft. They did quite well for themselves in the international signings right after the draft. And I do believe that the three trades that they made leading up to the trade deadline sent a real clear message and picture to a lot of people across baseball that even though the major league product right now is quite poor, just give it some time because there's a lot of talent bubbling up in their system, and they made some really smart moves. And I think that's going to be the big thing. You know, and it just stands out in my mind that what they did over, I'll say, an 8-week period this summer can positively shape what the culture and competitiveness of this franchise is going to look like over the next 3 to 5 years.
Wayne McDonald Jr., Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. He's written a lot about the Miami Marlins this year and done a great job for it, too. Going back to the very beginning of this episode here, Wayne, I thought Assan Diaz was going to be, because in all accounts, we all knew at some point he was going to be brought up to the major league level right after the trade deadline. We knew at some point. I was looking at this most recent, the homestand that starts as we are recording this on Thursday, the 7th of August. I thought, hey, you know what? He'll be sitting pretty, getting ready to come up here. And then you had a couple injuries come forth. But, you know, you brought up a good point that, you know, we shouldn't necessarily maybe be too surprised by this, and because, again, this was going to happen. Assan Diaz, one of the top prospects in all of baseball. Now he's reaching there. You know, we'll get to some of the other guys here in just a little bit. But man, first off, what was your take on him coming up as early or when he did, and what was your take on his first couple outings?
I was always operating on the thought process that sometime after the All-Star break, the Marlins were going to give him a look. And the reason why I thought this was Castro has a club option at the end of the year for, I think, $16 million. The Marlins are not going to pick that up. He's got a $1 million buyout. So clearly there's going to be opening at second base. I was always under the thought process that Curtis Grandison and Neil Walker and Starlin Castro were going to get moved. Clearly I was wrong, because they're still in Marlins uniforms. So I always had in the back of my mind that Diaz was going to see time on the major league roster this year. Now, if you really look at what he did in the minor leagues this year, I mean, over 102 games, this guy had a 973 OPS. He had 26 home runs, a 96 strikeouts over 377 at-bats. So this guy was putting up serious numbers. I mean, the guy almost had 1,000 OPS at the AAA level. So he was not only knocking on the door to the major leagues, he was putting his foot through the door. So I always knew that he was going to eventually make it through. I'm not surprised that it happened this week. I'm not surprised that he had a positive impact right away. But I look at it also from the bigger perspective that he was a part of the Yelich trade. And the Yelich trade can kind of go down as one of the worst trades that the Marlins ever made because of what Christian Yelich has become. Or it could go down as one of the best trades they made, because they got four prospects in that deal. And people forget, in that deal, they got Monte Harrison and Assan Diaz, along with Lewis Brinson and Jordan Yamamoto. So all those four guys right now are factoring heavily in the franchise's thinking, whether it be at the minor league level or the major league level, because Brinson has just been called up with Diaz just a couple of days ago. So, you know, I look at it from the perspective of, I'm not surprised. This was inevitable. I'm shocked that, you know, Castro's still there, to be honest with you. I thought he probably would have been the first ones to move and probably be one of the more attractive pieces. So this is just a pleasant addition that I kind of anticipated, I'm going to say, probably about a month or so ago.
Wayne McDonald Jr., Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. And talking about Brinson here again, he was part of one of the big flurry of trades. He was coming over, and you know, I don't know, Wayne, if I had ever heard as much hype for a guy, and I guess I could have. I guess I have. I mean, we've seen guys like Bryce Harper make their way up quickly, and you know, so kind of taking that out aside from the big guys who are making their waves right now in the game, you know, I don't think there's been too much hype coming in. And this, again, I've learned from you so much that this is why we do not say we won and we lost until we've won and we lost, because Brinson didn't have a great outing his first time when he hit the major leagues and he got sent down. It's kind of a chance to redeem himself up here. But, you know, do you feel like this is more of, hey, let's just give him a shot, or has he really earned this chance to get up here, and what will he do with it?
That's a great question, because I go back to, you know, what Don Mattingly was saying at the winter meetings, where, you know, Brinson needed to kind of step away from baseball after the way last season ended, and he was somewhat overwhelmed. I think the strikeouts were an issue, without question. Now, depending upon who you talk to in the game, I still think hitters striking out at alarmingly high rates is a little bit of a problem, but that's just me. But then he made the major league roster and really got off to a rough start. And, you know, being demoted to AAA playing in New Orleans, you know, he played 81 games down there. And what I look at, because it's very hard with the minor league stats to, you know, to do the deep analytics that we do at the major league level and really dive deeply into it. I'm big on strikeout percentage, and I look at contact and everything. Brinson struck out, had a strikeout percentage of roughly 34% of the time. You know, that's still high. You know, he struck out 100 times over 296 at-bats. But I look at some encouraging signs. An encouraging sign is his OPS was 871. So it's trending in the right direction. I think what's going to happen with Brinson right now for the remainder of the season is that the Marlins are going to give him a serious look. But here is where Brinson needs to start to produce and perform at a higher level now, is because the Marlins are loaded with outfielders in their system. And yeah, don't be surprised if J.J. Bleda is knocking on the door to be on the major league roster at some point next year. They drafted Cameron Mizner out of Missouri as well. Another he was the supplemental pick, another guy that they're very high on. There's a lot of prospects in the Marlins system that are outfielders. So, and throw in Monte Harrison. Monte Harrison's out for the remainder of the year with a wrist injury, but that's another top-flight prospect. So I think right now we're at a point with Brinson where he needs to show something quickly, because the Marlins do have other options and alternatives in terms of prospects in the outfield. And they're all cut from the same mold. 6'3", 6'4", 225 pounds. So I do believe that Brinson's going to be given an opportunity, and it's going to be up to him whether or not he seizes it, because there's a lot of outfield talent in the Marlins farm system.
Once again, everybody, Wayne McDonald Jr., Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. You talk about the Christian Yelich trade here, and again, ladies and gentlemen, I go with the Miami Marlins right now because I think they're the epitome of, you know, you could be seeing a very, very, very good team in the next 5+ years. I mean, you could be seeing a new version of the Astros. And I know a lot of people love to get in touch with who's the hot team right now, what's going on. But, man, you know what, Wayne, I may be an odd cookie here, but, you know, I just feel like this, you know, going and looking at – that's why I love the minor leagues. That's why I love college baseball, because I could be seeing the stars of tomorrow and what's going on. And I think it's almost as fascinating to see how a team gets to there, how a team gets to being as dominant like the Astros are, and what the journey is like. Because, again, I remember the Astros. I went to a game when the Astros had a 50-win season. I saw that. Not a lot of fans, not a lot of support. But, you know, they knew. And so, again, everybody, that's why, if you're all curious as to why we're diving into the Marlins or diving into the Rangers or diving into teams that have no shot of making a postseason run in the next year or so, that's why. And speaking about the Yelich trade here, going one guy that I've loved, and obviously you have talked about a lot here, is Jordan Yamamoto, a guy that has been, I think, and you mentioned perfectly here, Wayne, we can either view it as the Marlins lost Yelich in what he's and his abilities of now, or they get a guy like Yamamoto and others who will make, and obviously in the mix there, Sixto Sanchez, Diaz, and all that. But in terms of Yamamoto, you got a guy that has already proven he's able to hang with the major leagues right now.
but that he could be a cornerstone. And I think one of the biggest things you touched on is that the pitching for the Miami is kind of what's keeping them maybe afloat right now. How big will Yamamoto be? How big was his presence so far? How big will he be as this rotation looks to continue on?
I think when you look at a guy like Jordan Yamamoto and other young players, you have to manage your expectations, because he came out, started to perform very well, and looked as if he was, trending in the right direction for the Marlins. But lately, he's really hit some really rough patches, where it's very easy to kind of label him, is he really ready? I think when you look at him right now and what the Marlins have done, Marlins have had injuries. They've traded some of their relievers. They kind of changed the dynamic. Their starting pitching is kind of taking it under the chin. They just finished up an 0-6 road trip. So they have some knocks against them. But I look at it from this perspective. When you're going to assess the Marlins now and over the next 5 years, you're always going to have to go back to the Yelich trade, the Realmuto trade, the Ozuna trade, and the Stanton trade, and see what the Marlins got for them. And you look at it from this perspective. We talked about Jordan Yamamoto coming from the Yelich trade. Sixto Sanchez came from the Realmuto trade. Sandy Alcantara came from the Ozuna trade. So those are going to be important pieces. Alcantara, Yamamoto from the pitching perspective, because the Marlins do have a lot of depth in their farm system in terms of pitching. That's why they were able to trade a Zach Gallen, to get a Jazz Chisholm. And that was a pretty, interesting trade. The Diamondbacks were giving up on one of their top prospects in their farm system, and the Marlins were giving up their top five prospect in their system. So the Marlins know that they have depth in pitching. It might not be showing itself presently, but during the course of the year, up until the All-Star break, they were surprising people that, if I had to kind of put it loosely, they were a middle-of-the-pack starting rotation in the National League heading into the All-Star break. And for a team that was 20 or so games under 500, that's pretty impressive to say, they weren't posting a 6 ERA or anything, but they were middle of the pack. So it just shows that there's a lot of room for growth and improvement, but they made some nice strides. So if you're going to pick one positive thing that you saw from the Marlins so far this year, is that there have been glimpses of hope in their starting pitching. And Yamamoto has provided them some moments, even though his stock is down right now.
And once again, everybody, as we start to wind down things here, the one and only Wayne McDonald Jr., Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. And one quick thing that we kind of brushed on, and I want to go back to looking at Aaron Sanchez, who throughout this season, I think he was the prototypical guy that didn't get the benefit from his offense. He didn't get that. His record certainly isn't reflective of what he is truly capable of. And I think that was shown immediately when he went six innings and I believe held the Mariners without a hit and really did a lot of the legwork to get the 12th no-hitter in Houston Astros history. And, looking up, in some of the facts and as I dug, I realized here that, He's kind of in elite territory now. Greg Maddux was the last person to be as dominant or as effective in his start with the very first team after the trade deadline. So, Aaron Sanchez did pretty well there, and I think that's history in the making there. And I just wanted to point that out here, Wayne, because I think that there is something to be said. You do a lot of inventory on the teams that players are with, and we have to take that into consideration. And I think that getting Sanchez in there, I'm gonna arguably say that maybe, just maybe, he may be may have a slightly bigger impact than Greinke. But again, I can't really that's speculation at this point. But what is your take on how Aaron Sanchez, especially in his first outing as an Astro, and what he means to this team?
I am a firm believer that if you're a ball player who is stuck on a team that's either rebuilding or just really in the doldrums of just having a horrible season, and you're given a golden ticket to go to one of probably the top three teams in all of baseball, and not only are you going to be on a highly competitive ball club that's going to be in the postseason, but you're also going to be a World Series favorite, your mindset and mentality change immediately. You know, you talk about run support. You talk about having something to prove. Now, the funny thing is, and you and I have joked about it, you know, when we heard about the Greinke deal seconds before the trading deadline, everyone was just focused on that. It was like a big, bold lettering. And then underneath it in small lettering was Aaron Sanchez as well. And I look at it from the perspective of, yes, the Astros are going to put out Verlander, they're going to put out Cole, they're going to put out Greinke. Now you have Sanchez. Now, best of five series, a little bit different, but clearly the Astros are built to go deep into October. And to go into a game four and you're putting out an Aaron Sanchez, where right now the Yankees have a myriad of question marks at 1-2, you know, that's pretty formidable right there. And you know, I kind of felt that way with Starlin Castro, that he was a guy having a very down year on a ball club in the middle of rebuilding, and he had no future with that franchise past the season. Him going to a competitive ball club probably would have been a shot of adrenaline. And I think that's what's happening with Aaron Sanchez, is that a shot of adrenaline has occurred, because now he's playing for a highly competitive ball club, and every time he steps on the rubber, he's got to prove something. And as well as the fact that he's playing on a really important ball club, and that every game matters rather than just playing out the string. Every game now that the Houston Astros play from here until October matters, and he could not say that in Toronto, and that clearly changes your mindset as a pitcher. And I think that might be one of those deals that goes under the radar that you and I will be talking about at some point in October and go, wow, that was a really great deal. Yeah, they got Greinke, and that's phenomenal. But wow, that's another really solid deal. And that only happens, and then we'll talk about that, if the Astros win the World Series or they go deep into October, because they have not only built for this year, they're built for a couple of years going forward.
Once again, everybody, Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money and Forbes.com joining the show here. Hope you have really enjoyed this so far, because I really tried to phrase this episode as a post-deadline effect show. You know, what are the effects? What are we seeing of those effects? Because Wayne and I are in agreement. You don't know who wins and loses. You don't know how good or bad you've got it until it actually happens. And so it's a very brief look, but we have a look anyway. So hope you've enjoyed it so far. Right now, we're going to move on to general news within the world of baseball. And something in connection with the trade deadline is Jonathan Lucroy on the move. He's going to be a Chicago Cub. Now, Wayne, this year, everybody knows that the 31st is a hard and fast deadline. It's the only deadline that baseball has. Yet, Jonathan Lucroy is on the move. So without me getting into the minutia of it all, how in the world do we see Lucroy moving on to the Chicago Cubs despite the 31st deadline? And is this something that we could see teams or players employ more within the future?
Well, essentially what it boils down to, let's do the macro view of it rather than getting caught into the weeds of it. It's just Jonathan Lucroy was just taken off the Major League roster. And essentially that basically designated him almost as if, and I don't want to say, it's basically like a free agent in a way, but has to clear waivers because he has an opportunity to go back, I think it was the Angels, if I'm not mistaken, and, you know, take a minor league assignment or have another team swoop him up. And for a week now, a lot of people have been kind of monitoring that situation because that's a nice veteran ball player that you add to a competitive ball club. So when a ball club, it's called a DFA, designated for assignment, that essentially means is you're taking a major league ball player off the major league roster, and one of two things is going to happen. They're going to accept a minor league assignment with an overwhelming majority of these veterans not doing, or they technically become available, and it's not like it's not really free agency, but you become available to sign with another ball club.
Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. If you were kind of curious or very curious, you now know exactly what's going on here. And again, I'm talking with Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports, MoneyForbes.com. And now another part here, I just wanted to touch base with you here on Wayne. We saw recently, and again, I love the chance for anybody to represent the USA. I'm really big into that, representing the USA in any sport, really. But we now see Joe Girardi. He's excited for a second shot at Olympic dreams. He will lead the USA at qualifying tournament. Joe Girardi has been out of the coaching game for a while. He is now slightly back in. I wouldn't say this is a full dip in. What have you kind of heard regarding this here, Wayne? Is this a gateway to possibly see him back in as a coach within the next few years? Or is this just simply something that's, hey, I can coach for the USA, I can be a part of it and go back to my broadcasting?
See, I love it. I think this is a phenomenal move for Joe Girardi because it kind of gives him the best of both worlds right now. The official announcement comes out tomorrow with the press conference and everything for Girardi, but he's going to have a very busy fall going through qualifying. I think it's in the month of November, if I'm not mistaken, that the qualifying for the Tokyo 2020 Olympics will begin, because Team USA has to secure a berth. But I also think it gives Girardi that opportunity to continue with his broadcasting career as well. I think it's just a really smart move for USA Baseball, because you're dealing with a man who has a ferocious work ethic. He's passionate. He's going to be highly prepared. And I think USA Baseball is in very good hands because he brings a winning pedigree and culture. And that's very important because, right now we really want to make sure that we get USA Baseball into the Tokyo Olympics and really start to make a name. And I think that this was a perfect, perfect hire because Girardi's bringing some valuable lessons that he learned from his decade-long experience managing the Yankees in the Bronx, as well as his, really thoughtful and detailed analyses as a broadcaster. But most importantly, it gets a really good manager back in the game at a very important part of the game of baseball. Everyone thinks only about, is he going to manage the Cubs one day or, the Mets or whatever it is, rather than, hey, an opportunity to win a gold medal in the Olympics and get some unfinished business after being one of the final cuts off the 84 Olympic team. This is a big deal, and I really think it's a positive step in the right direction for USA Baseball, and it's just a really smart move for Joe Girardi because he's a guy who has a lot of passion and intelligence for the game, and he can impart that upon the younger generation after learning the lessons he did managing the younger players, where he might have struggled a little bit in the Bronx at the latter years of his tenure there. But this is another golden opportunity for him to reconnect and to really share his knowledge. I think it's a great hire.
I think it's amazing. I always loved Joe Girardi. Despite not being a Yankee fan, I respect the greatness of Joe Girardi. And again, everybody, Joe Girardi looking to be the next guy to come up and lead the team for the USA to potentially get into the Tokyo Olympics here coming on up. So be on the lookout for that for sure. And finally here, Wayne, of course, we've talked on so many different things here. I want to, before I leave, just kind of give the floor. Is there anything else that really has jumped off to you that maybe we should be looking out that we may not have touched on or that many people may not look for?
I think one thing that I would share with everyone that I think is very important, just being a baseball fan and a student of the game, is there's a lot of great books out there this summer that really take your knowledge of the game to the next level. I'm a big fan of the David Cone book with Jack Curry. full count, the education of a pitcher. If you want to learn about pitching and you want to get a deeper knowledge of it, this book is phenomenal because Cohn really lets you get inside his head and what he was thinking. And I think it was a phenomenal book if you're looking for a nice summer read. Another one, and you and I have talked about it, is the Bud Selig biography, or autobiography in a way. It's a complicated read because you have a hard time struggling with your emotions. But if you get past a lot of it, you got to really focus on one key fact. He brought baseball back to Milwaukee. And what he did and his story, no matter what you think of him in terms of the steroids and PEDs and all that other stuff that have been, you know, demerits on his career, you just have a deeper appreciation of what he did to get baseball back into Milwaukee. And another really solid summer read. And right now I'm kind of going through Tyler Kepner's latest book, and that's another really good book. So I just encourage everyone out there, there's a lot of really good summer reading in terms of great baseball books. And, you know, if you're really looking to enhance your knowledge, those are three great books that I highly recommend right now.
And definitely, I think we should all go straight to our local bookstore and grab some of those. Also, I'll put out there, I'm reading the Cerebral Effect of Baseball here, talking about the mental side of the game. And also a book I think I'm going to love here and can't wait to read is The Power of Sports and the media and how it affects the American culture. But again, I love summer reads. I can't wait to dive into it. And again, Wayne McDonald, just as much as I had so much fun, I can't wait to get into our next conversation.
Same here, Andrew. We always have a lot of fun with these and look forward to future conversations as the season progresses.
Once again, everybody, that was Wayne McDonald Jr. of Forbes Sports Money, Forbes.com. Check him out online. Just type in Wayne McDonald Jr. Look for that blue check mark. Look for him. And he has a lot of great stuff on Twitter. So check him out, as well as Bob Tufts, a good friend of the show's as well. Check them both out on Twitter. Check the show out at The Long Ball One on Twitter as well. And all the episodes will be put up, including this one. It's up on there. Going to be getting into iHeartRadio with this episode, with this podcast anyway. This will be up on iHeartRadio here within the next few weeks, so be on the lookout for that. Also, check my Twitter, check Facebook for all the different Last Word on Baseball articles that I have written. I got some more in the works here coming on up. Please check that out. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, before we reach a full hour with this segment, I know that the episodes with Wayne tend to be long, but man, they are jam-packed with a lot of great information, a lot of great stuff. But without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, in the next coming weeks, we're going to have Dan McDonald, head coach for the University of Louisville. He coached the collegiate U.S. national team this summer. We're going to get in touch with him and check out how his summer has been past the College World Series. And, of course, we're going to get in touch with some authors in the world of baseball writing. So stay with that. Stay tuned with that. And, of course, have fun, ladies and gentlemen. Baseball is a great sport. It's America's pastime. Let's treat it as such. That's it for me, ladies and gentlemen. Until we meet again, like they say in the showbiz world, stay safe.